Today is Thursday, July 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, more on the arrest in Hong Kong as authorities take in demonstrators who broke into the city's legislative complex.
This is very likely just the beginning of the authorities' response.
An Australian student detained in North Korea is released. Also, new terrorism laws take effect in Australia. And a look ahead at today's controversial celebration in Washington. Those stories and more are ahead on today's International Edition. Hong Kong pro-democracy lawmaker expressed fears Thursday that the situation could worsen after police announced the arrests of more than a dozen people following protests earlier this week. Legislative Council member Claudia Mo called on people to understand the frustration and anger of the mostly youthful protesters, even if they have technically broken the law. VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo is currently in Hong Kong, and I spoke to him earlier about the situation there. So, Bill, authorities in Hong Kong announced that they have made a number of arrests related to the demonstrators breaking into the Legislative Council building. What can you tell us about what we know so far about them?
They have made a handful of arrests of people who are involved in the activities the day of the Legislative Council break-in. But I think that what we know so far is that this is very likely just the beginning of the authorities' response. People expect not only some wave of arrests, maybe even more than what we've seen, but also steps that are not related at all to the Legislative Council break-in. I mean, there was a real sense after the umbrella movement protests here that Beijing mandated basically collective punishment, disqualifying lawmakers, taking all kinds of other kind of subversive steps to punish everyone for what they saw as the misdeeds of certain protesters. So there is a real fear that there will be these types of steps that are forthcoming.
And what's that doing to the mood of those living in Hong Kong, especially among those pro-democracy legislative members, as well as those who are coming out in protest against the extradition bill?
It's really dark. I was there 2 weeks ago for the protest in which an estimated 2 million people showed up. At that protest, there were families, there were children, there were old people, a real cross-section of Hong Kong society. And then while there was anger, there was a sense of celebration almost. I mean, everyone was in it together, and they were optimistic. And now, especially after the incidents at the Legislative Council, this has turned really dark. I think that people realize they're not going to get results just by doing peaceful protests. And a large number of, at least, well, we don't know how big the number is, but a certain number of people are willing to take the next steps and escalate this very intentionally. So you saw this Legislative Council break-in. You saw people committing acts of vandalism against a specific target, this symbol of an institution that they don't think is representing them.
Moving forward, as we approach the weekend, what's likely to happen on the streets of Hong Kong?
There are calls for protests on Sunday. And I think that these protests will be seen sort of as a gauge of what the better called vandalism than violence at the Legislative Council, what that has done to possibly hurt the support of the general public. There were concerns that possibly, you know, the man on the street, the man and woman on the street in Hong Kong would support the goals of the protesters, but would not support them tearing up, basically smashing the legislature. Will that result in fewer people coming out to this next protest on Sunday? It's very possible, but it's also important to note people have been protesting here very consistently in very large numbers for a long time, and I think it's hard to keep up that momentum, for very long. So it may be a gauge of support here, but it may not be an accurate one.
That was VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo in Hong Kong. An Australian student has been released after a week of detention in North Korea. Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced to Parliament that 29-year-old Alex Sigley had been released.
I can inform the House that Alex Sigley is now safely in the Australian Embassy in Beijing, I understand his family, his father, will soon be able to speak to him, and I can only imagine the relief and joy that his father must feel.
Sigley looked relaxed and gave a peace sign when he arrived at Beijing Airport. He did not respond to reporters' questions about what had happened in Pyongyang, but his father, Gary Sigley, did.
I just spoke to Alec, and he's in good spirits, and he's looking forward to seeing his wife as soon as possible.
North Korea has been accused in the past of detaining Westerners and using them as political pawns to gain concessions. Australia advises people to reconsider their need to travel to North Korea and warns that foreigners have been subject to arbitrary arrests and long detentions. Russian President Vladimir Putin disclosed Thursday for the first time that a top-secret military submarine hit by a fatal fire 3 days ago was nuclear-powered, prompting Russia's defense minister to assure him that its nuclear reactor had been contained. Russian officials have faced accusations of trying to cover up the full details of the incident. The men were killed carrying out what the defense ministry called a survey of the seafloor near the Arctic. Putin said 7 held the rank of captain, first class, and 2 were holders of the Hero of Russia, the highest military award issued in the post-World War II period. The defense ministry said the incident took place on Monday, but it was not officially disclosed until late on Tuesday. In addition, Russian President Vladimir Putin also emphasized strong ties with Italy before a one-day visit to Rome that will also include a meeting with Pope Francis. Here are other major stories from around the globe. A supertanker believed to be breaching European Union sanctions by carrying a shipment of Iranian crude oil to war-ravaged Syria has been detained in Gibraltar. A tornado swept through northeastern China in the province of Liaoning Wednesday, killing 6 and injuring 190, the state broadcaster said, amid a series of extreme weather events that government forecasters have linked to climate change. Sudan's protest leaders Wednesday agreed to hold direct talks with the country's ruling general after the African Union and Ethiopian moderators called on the two sides to resume stalled negotiations to form a new governing body. You'll find these stories and more on our website. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
As a young child, you may have been ordered to eat your broccoli because it's good for you. Well, this sage advice is actually based in science. Past studies provided evidence that broccoli and other cruciferous vegetables like cabbage, cauliflower, and Brussels sprouts may play a role in inhibiting the growth of common forms of human cancer. A new study led by Dr. Pier Paolo Pandolfi at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center suggests that a gene called WWP1 produces an enzyme that interferes with the work of a powerful cancer-suppressing gene called PTEN. Working with mice, Dr. Pandolfi and his team found evidence that I3C, a compound found in cruciferous vegetables, can shut down the production of this enzyme that keeps PTEN from doing its job in fighting cancer. The study was published in the journal Science. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. President Donald Trump facing renewed criticism from Democrats and activists over his handling of a migrant crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border said in a Twitter post Wednesday that immigrants unhappy with conditions at detention centers should be told not to come. Democratic lawmakers and civil rights activists who have visited migrant detention centers along the border in recent days have described nightmarish conditions that marked by overcrowding and inadequate access to food, water, and other basic needs. This week, UNICEF's executive director released a statement saying coordinated action is urgently needed to keep migrant children safe. International Edition's own Lori London talked about it with UNICEF Communications Officer for Emergencies, Chris Tidy.
Everything that we've heard, or that's certainly been reported in the last few days and weeks with regard to the conditions that some migrant children are facing in some of the facilities along the southern border. Those reports are deeply concerning to us. You know, any time you're hearing about you know, children without access to the services and the support they need, you know, whether it be healthcare, education, protection, or just to be with their family, when you hear about that, that's very concerning. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, children are the most vulnerable, and when you're talking about a vulnerable group of people to begin with, which would be refugees and migrants, then the children among them are in an especially precarious position, and so these reports are very alarming to us.
I know that UNICEF came out about a year ago when it came to light that the U.S. was separating families, and they were, you know, strongly against any such thing. Does it look to be, from your perspective, that it hasn't really improved since then, as far as what we're seeing with all these children without any adults?
It seems as though that it's unclear at this stage. Certainly, there are children at the southern border who are either arriving without their parents, so they're arriving unaccompanied, or for whatever reason there's some separation that's going on before or after they cross. That separation, you know, as we've said before and said many times, when a child is separated from, especially a young child is separated from their parents, from their caregivers, that can be extremely traumatic for children. And, you know, I think what a lot of people don't know is that, you know, yes, it's traumatic and upsetting for children in you know, in the short term, but it can also undermine their long-term development, because, you know, there's a potential there for the buildup of toxic stress when children are faced with those sorts of situations. And that can really have longer-term consequences for them as well. You know, so regardless, it really needs to stop. Children have a right to be with their family, to be with their parents. You know, and we would hope that any government anywhere in the world that you know, that is caring for refugee and migrant children would make sure that those kids are kept with their families.
The president on Wednesday said that these conditions that they're coming to are much better than what they're leaving, and that if they don't like it, they shouldn't come. Do these people really want to leave their countries?
No. I think I could say that pretty categorically. I've spent time in the region speaking with children and families from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And, you know, virtually everyone who I spoke with basically said that, you know, they left or were choosing to leave because they felt they had no other option.
That was UNICEF Communications Officer for Emergencies, Chris Tidy, speaking with our own Lori London. The bombing in Libya's capital that killed at least 44 people, with some reports saying as many as 55 and injured more than 130 on Tuesday night, may amount to a war crime, according to United Nations officials. Tripoli officials attribute the attack to the forces loyal to Khalifa Haftar, a strongman who leads the military in eastern Libya. Haftar's forces have been locked in a battle against forces loyal to the internationally backed government in the capital of Tripoli for 3 months. They are fighting for control of the city and the future of the Libyan government. However, after this airstrike, his forces have said they do not attack civilian targets. The war has now killed about 700 people and displaced 94,000. The International Committee of the Red Cross is calling for the urgent revival of Yemen's stalled peace process to end the conflict that is deepening the country's already catastrophic humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The ICRC's director for the Near and Middle East region, Fabrizio Carboni, just returned from a mission to Yemen and does not mince his words. He says the country has collapsed and only a political solution will restore the hopes and future of millions of destitute people. Delegates from the warring parties, the Houthi and Yemeni government, attended UN-mediated talks in Stockholm, Sweden on December 13, 2018. This was the first time the warring sides had met in 2 years. Carboni says the so-called Stockholm Agreement, which emerged from the talks, achieved some promising humanitarian accords, but is now blocked. One of the casualties of the breakdown, he says, was a prisoner swap agreed to by the parties to the conflict. He says the ICRC was ready to oversee the implementation of the prisoner exchange between the government and Houthi rebels earlier in the year. He says the operation, however, was aborted at the last minute.
Within the limits of our humanitarian work, we're really ready to go the extra mile. And that's what we did for the release of detainees. I mean, everything was ready. You know, we had the planes, we were in the collection point, everything, we're there. You know, you just have to push the button, start, and it happens.
Carboni says the ICRC is on standby, ready to go as soon as it is given the green light by the warring parties. In the meantime, he says, Red Cross delegates continue to visit detainees to check on their well-being. He tells VOA their conditions of detention are very difficult. He says their cells are stiflingly hot and humid with no air conditioning.
In places of detention who were built decades ago, if not century ago, we have, for instance, very often a problem of scabies. And you can imagine scabies in such an environment, it's a torture. It's hell. It's really hell.
The ICRC official says he believes all states and parties involved in this conflict want to find a way out of this tragedy. But this, he says, implies trade-offs. This means the parties have to negotiate and be willing to compromise on the issues. He understands the difficulties, but says he remains optimistic it can be done. The UN considers Yemen the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world. It reports 17,700 civilians have been killed. This since the Saudi-led coalition began airstrikes against the Houthi rebels in March 2015 in support of the Yemeni government. The UN says more than 3.3 million people are displaced and 80% of the population, or 24 million people, need humanitarian assistance, with more than half of them being children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Australia is expected to introduce anti-terror laws to Parliament that would ban foreign fighters from returning home for up to 2 years. Phil Mercer reports the government has said the measures are necessary to protect Australia from extremism, but critics have insisted they would violate the rights of citizens.
Australia is expected to introduce anti-terror laws to Parliament Thursday that would ban foreign fighters from returning home for up to 2 years. The government has said the measures are necessary to protect Australia from extremism, but critics have insisted they'd violate the rights of citizens. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports. The bill is based on legislation in the United Kingdom and aims to prevent the return of Australian citizens suspected of fighting with militant groups overseas. Ministers have said Australia needs new powers to stop them bringing their dangerous ideology home until authorities are ready to deal with them. Under the proposed new law, they could be excluded for up to 2 years. Australia's Home Affairs Minister is Peter Dutton.
These people want to do us harm. For us, we're dealing with people who have now acquired the skill of putting together an IED, have worked with ISIL, and have a right to come back to our country, and we need to protect our citizens.
But critics believe the proposed legislation is unconstitutional. The Law Council of Australia said it was a dog's breakfast or a mess. It insisted all citizens have the legal right to return home without permission from officials. Helen Irving, a professor of law at the University of Sydney, believes the plans to exclude foreign fighters should be scrapped.
All Australian citizens have a constitutional right to return to Australia without having to obtain a licence or a clearance from the executive. It is in the nature of Australian citizenship.
This week, two men were charged with an alleged terrorist conspiracy to attack targets in Sydney. Investigators say the pair, Radwan Dadak and Isaac El Matari, who were both in their early 20s, were influenced by Islamic State, and that El Matari had planned to travel to Afghanistan to join the extremist group. They were arrested in coordinated raids in Sydney Tuesday. Authorities said it was the 16th alleged major plot to have been foiled in Australia since 2014. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Washington's July 4th celebration today on the National Mall promises to differ from the traditional event in more than one way. U.S. President Donald Trump will be giving a speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and has ordered the presence of military tanks and flyovers of fighter jets. VOA's Lattice Hoke has more.
Battle tanks, armored vehicles, and flyovers by fighter jets are not common in U.S. 4th of July events. Neither is a presidential speech on the occasion. But President Trump is determined to have a celebration like no other and says he wants to honor the U.S. military. Critics accuse him of politicizing a holiday that has traditionally united Americans of every ilk. Some people welcome the opportunity to see the president.
I think he's the president and he has the obligation to talk to the people. And if that's what he wants to do, and if he wants to do it on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, I'm all for it.
Trump was openly impressed with the Bastille Day military parade he attended in 2017 in Paris and said he wanted one in Washington. During last week's G20 meeting in Japan, Russian President Vladimir Putin invited him to the 2020 World War II victory parade in Moscow's Red Square. Putin's aide Yuri Ushakov said Trump took much interest in the proposal.
We have invited the President of the United States to visit us for the 75th anniversary of the victory in World War II on May 9th next year. The U.S. President reacted very positively.
Some Americans are questioning the cost of military shows for American taxpayers and are frowning at Trump's taste for displays of military prowess. Opponents have obtained permission to bring to the National Mall a giant baby Trump balloon, like the one displayed during the president's visits to London. Tourists in Washington may be treated to more entertainment than expected.
We're here on a three-week road trip from Kansas City, Missouri. We come up here for 4th of July, see the fireworks.
Washington's July 4th fireworks are America's most spectacular. Trump promises that this year they will be the biggest ever. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today on this July 4th, the U.S. Independence Day. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and engineer Aydin Utku, thank you so much for joining us. Now for pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow The Voice of America on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, if you have our VOA mobile app, you'll be able to download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a tremendous Thursday.